All right, okay, we're going to get started now. So this session is on Hamas, Fatah, and the state of Palestinian resistance today. The speaker is Nick Everett, and he's going to be speaking for a while.
About half an hour or so,
and that will be followed by discussion. Nick is a member of Socialist Alternative in Perth. He's been a Palestine solidarity activist in a number of cities across the country, Perth, Sydney, and Brisbane. And currently he's the co-convener of the Friends of Palestine in Western Australia. So he'll speak, and then, as I said, maybe you kind of keep your comments, write them down, thoughts, questions, whatever they might be, and then we'll come to them afterwards.
First, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people whose land on which we meet, and to acknowledge the elders of the Kulin Nation, past and present. I think it's also appropriate at the beginning of this talk to acknowledge the Palestinians who have fallen in their struggle just in the last couple of days in Gaza, where we've seen Israel fire on a peaceful demonstration, killing 16 Palestinians. And I think we'll be looking at a solidarity action of some kind, perhaps in our later Palestine session today, or a photo in regard to that. Okay, so to begin, I want to start with this quote from Franz Fanon from his book, The Wretched of the Earth. Fanon observes, "The national middle class, which takes over power at the end of the colonial regime, is an underdeveloped middle class. It has practically no economic power, and in any case is in no way commensurate with the bourgeoisie of the mother country in which it hopes to replace. The national bourgeoisie of underdeveloped countries is not engaged in production, nor in invention, nor building, nor labour. It is completely canalised into activities of the intermediary type. Its innermost vocation seems to be keeping in the running and to be part of the racket. The psychology of the national bourgeoisie is that of the businessman, not that of the captain of industry, and it is only too true that the greed of the settlers and the system of embargoes set up by colonialism has hardly left them any other choice." Well, these words were written in 1961, but I think you could fairly say they embody the character of the politically bankrupt Ramallah-based Palestinian Authority today. There is, however, one difference. Israel's colonial regime has not ended. Indeed, its military and economic power appears to be growing stronger every day. A creation of the 1993 Oslo Accords, the PA exercises direct control over only a fifth of the West Bank territory and joint authority in collaboration with Israel of another fifth. It is in almost every respect an appendage to the Israeli state, beholden to Israel's key allies which finance it. The PA today spends $1 billion annually on its security apparatus, half of its civil service. This security apparatus does not resist Israel's colonial occupation, it helps police it. Palestinian activists and journalists who criticise the PA are subject to harassment, detention, and even execution by joint operations of the PA and Israeli security forces. According to the unelected 83-year-old Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the Fatah faction that he leads, the PA is in fact a Palestinian state in formation. Yet Israel's colonisation continues with a vengeance. In 25 years since the Oslo Accords, the number of Israeli settlers in the Palestinian occupied territories has tripled. A network of checkpoints, walls and Israeli-only roads strangle the lifeblood of West Bank villages. For Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, the situation is even worse. Over the past decade, Palestinians in Gaza have endured a series of devastating military assaults and continue to live under siege. Homes still lie in ruins, both electricity and drinking water are in short supply, and half the population depends upon emergency food assistance. As desperate as this situation is, Palestinian national liberation struggle faces a paradox. While Palestinians endure a colonial occupation as harsh as at any time since 1948, their struggle continues to enjoy popular support, especially among the Arab masses. Over the last decade, the boycott, divestments and sanctions campaign has brought international attention to the injustice of Israeli apartheid. 17-year-old Palestinian political prisoner Ahed Tamimi has emerged as a symbol of the steadfastness of a new generation of Palestinians who refuse to give up their rights. Well, this paradox can only be understood if we recognise that both Fatah and Hamas don't rule for all Palestinians, but rather for a minority, I would say a tiny minority, the Palestinian bourgeoisie. Confronted with Israel's iron wall, the Fatah-led PA has for the last quarter century pursued an endless and ultimately fruitless strategy of negotiations with Israel. Dependent upon the patronage of neighbouring Arab states and imperialist powers, Abbas has no realistic prospect of securing an independent, viable Palestinian state so long as Israel, the most powerful military in the Middle East, the most powerful military power in the Middle East, continues to enjoy the support of Washington. Against the backdrop of the failed Oslo Accords, Hamas appeared to offer the promise of a more militant, uncompromising strategy. Yet after having ruled Gaza for more than a decade, Hamas too is seeking to negotiate its way out of this impasse in which it finds itself, pursuing conciliation with Fatah and embracing a two-state solution. Well, this talk will examine the evolution of both factions and the contradictions within their strategies that have led to the present impasse. At different times in the course of the Palestinian national liberation struggle, each faction has harnessed a militant and mobilised mass base of support. Yet today, both oversee essentially clientelist regimes, which serve as distribution channels of foreign aid to an impoverished and beleaguered population. If Palestinian liberation is to amount to more than a precarious existence under the shadow of Israeli occupation, an alternative strategy is needed, a strategy that seeks to combine the determined resistance of the Palestinian youth with the social power of the Arab working class across the region and also with our international solidarity. In the years preceding 1948, Palestinian nationalism emerged from the struggle against British mandate and the colonialist Zionist movement. The first wave of nationalist struggle faced a cruel defeat. The Zionist military campaigns of 1948, known collectively as the Nakba, drove at least 850,000 Palestinians from their homes, forced into exile in Gaza, the West Bank, and neighbouring Arab countries. The Nakba served to intensify class differences. The vast majority of Palestinian refugees, peasants, workers, urban poor, lived in squalid refugee camps administered by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt. However, a small minority, including landowners, merchants, bankers, and entrepreneurs, were more fortunate. Palestinian businessmen able to do so transferred assets to the neighbouring Arab countries. So great was the exodus of Palestinian capital that the money supply in Jordan doubled in the early 1950s. Some skilled Palestinian workers were able to leave the camps to find work in their host countries or in the booming oil industries of the Gulf states. However, Arab rulers treated most Palestinians as unwelcome visitors, fearing their potential to be a politically destabilising force. Palestinian refugees faced both formal and informal discrimination. In Jordan, some skilled workers gained employment in the public service, while in Lebanon, Palestinians were barred from state employment. The vast majority of refugees depended on UNRWA aid for their survival. For Palestinians able to gain a foothold in the booming oil industry of the Gulf states, life was very different. Some Palestinian skilled workers played significant roles in the establishment of trade unions, but hundreds were expelled for their union and political activism. Palestinian businessmen prospered in construction and commerce, while teachers, doctors, lawyers, civil engineers and administrators secured employment in the public sector and in new service industries. Some became wealthy, including a group of young entrepreneurs based in Kuwait who formed the nucleus of Fatah, the Palestinian Liberation Movement. One of the most prominent was Yasser Arafat, an engineer in the Ministry of Works who ran a lucrative contracting business. Despite their economic status, Palestinian businessmen and professionals in the Gulf states were, like the refugees in the camps, denied citizenship and prohibited from playing any meaningful role in local politics. This embryonic Palestinian bourgeoisie increasingly became preoccupied with how to secure its status within an independent Palestinian state. Well, from the early 1950s, Arafat and his colleagues sought help from Arab leaders such as Gamal Abdel Nasser, who led Egypt's Free Officers movement. Nasser won support throughout the Arab world for his abolition of the monarchy, agrarian reform, and nationalisation of the Suez Canal. In 1958, Egypt and Syria formed a United Arab Republic, advocating a pan-Arab union. In the same year, a nationalist regime came to power in Iraq after overthrowing the pro-British monarchy. The Ba'ath, or Resurrection Party, with a strong base amongst students, professionals and army officers, became and the Arab Nationalist Movement, the ANM, founded by the Palestinian George Habash in Lebanon, became poles of attraction for exiled Palestinians who embraced their pan-Arab nationalism. Strongly supportive of Nasser, the ANM argued that the fate of Palestinians depended upon pan-Arab unity. The liberation of Palestine could only be achieved, they argued, by driving imperialism out of the Arab world. There's a quote from Nasser there which reflects the certainly the rhetoric of pan-Arab nationalism that saw Palestinian liberation as key to its project. But they argued, as I said, that this needed to be an Arab-wide revolt to drive out the imperial forces. Well, when Al-Fatah emerged in the late 1950s, Arafat and his supporters turned this strategy on its head. They argued that the State of Israel represented the key obstacle to forging Arab unity. As a consequence, an independent Palestinian national liberation movement was needed. Fatah offered a simple message. All Palestinians should join the struggle to liberate their homeland from Zionism. The movement emphasised the common interests of Palestinians as a national group. However, a contradiction underlay its strategy from the outset. The majority of Palestinians had been exiled from their homeland a decade before. What role should they play in their host countries? Fatah's leadership was adamant that Palestinians should maintain peace with neighbouring Arab regimes, which they hoped to enlist as allies in the struggle for Palestinian liberation. Algeria's liberation in 1962 appeared to offer a path forward. The Algerian National Liberation Front defeated France's colonial settler regime through a protracted guerrilla struggle that drew in all social classes. Palestinians seeking to emulate the Algerian example flocked to Fatah in droves. Fatah's rapid growth began to worry Arab leaders, who espoused militant anti-imperialist rhetoric, but repressed political activism among their own populations. In 1964, hoping to contain and control a rising Palestinian National Liberation Movement, Nasser initiated the Palestinian Liberation Organisation. However, the PLO soon fell under Fatah's influence. In 1965, Fatah launched a campaign of guerrilla warfare against Israeli forces from its base in Jordan's refugee camps. Its campaign of mass revolutionary violence drew inspiration from the ideas of radical Islamic preacher Izz ad-Din Qassam, whose militant Black Hand movement resisted both Zionism and British occupation in the early 1930s. It also sought to emulate the guerrilla struggles that had defeated the Kuomintang nationalists in China, the French colonialists in Vietnam and Algeria in the preceding decades. The conditions in Palestine were less favourable for waging a guerrilla struggle. There was no mountainous terrain or dense forest in which their guerrilla fighters could obtain cover. Moreover, Fatah had no base of support inside the territories conquered by Zionists in 1948. The Palestinian population was uprooted and dispersed. In contrast, by the mid-1960s, Israel had emerged as the dominant military power in the region, enjoying support from major imperialist powers, including the US, France, and Britain. In 1967, the Six-Day War further enhanced Israel's power when it rapidly took control of the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and the Gaza Strip. Nonetheless, the armed struggle did offer an attractive, if largely symbolic, form of resistance for Palestinians in the camps. In 1967, several hundred guerrilla fighters, known as the Fedayeen, crossed into the West Bank from Jordan to engage the occupying Israeli army. Militarily, the action was a defeat, with many fighters killed or captured. However, other Fedayeen groups also emerged, organised under the PLO umbrella, and in some cases backed by neighbouring regimes. These included the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, the armed wing of the Arab Nationalist Movement, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the DFLP, the PFLP General Command, backed by Syria, and the Arab Liberation Front, backed by Iraq. Unable to establish liberated zones inside Palestine, these groups struggled for hegemony within the refugee camps in neighbouing countries. Fatah soon emerged the dominant force. Its fighters' defeat of a 15,000-strong Israeli force at Karame on the east bank of the Jordan River offered a significant morale boost and served as a magnet for Fatah recruitment. Arms and money were now flowing in from Arab states, and al-Fatah had moved to centre stage. I've got here two front covers of Time magazine. This is 1968 and 1970. And 1968, the time of the Battle of Karame. Obviously, the international context, I think, is very important in understanding the Palestinian armed struggle. This is the same year as the Tet Offensive and a whole radicalisation worldwide. But as I'm going to explain, by 1970, this situation led to a showdown in Jordan. Well, an increasingly militant and combative Fatah-led movement within the camps sat at odds with the other key element of Fatah's strategy, non-interference in the affairs of neighbouring Arab states. The approach was sacred to the PLO's Fatah leadership because it kept open the door to arms and money from neighbouring Arab regimes. Moreover, it played a central part in Fatah's political strategy, which aimed to convince Arab rulers that their sponsorship of a Palestinian state was in their interests. However, this policy was to have devastating consequences, first in Jordan and then in Lebanon. In both countries, where the PLO soon found itself in control of the refugee camps, Palestinian autonomy stood uncomfortably alongside the authoritarian rule of Arab regimes. Confrontation soon became inevitable. The grassroots organisation of the Fedayeen offered promise to Palestinian refugees who deeply resented Jordan's authoritarian Hashemite monarchy. Radicals within the PLO, including those organised in the PFLP and DFLP, but also many Fatah cadre, called for the overthrow of Jordan's monarchy. They had a strong base of support. 70% of Jordan's population were of Palestinian origin. King Hussein, in contrast, had a weak base of support, limited to landowners, businessmen and nomadic tribal leaders. He relied heavily on the British-trained Jordanian army, whose support was not assured. According to Abu Daoud, commander of the PLO's guerrilla operations, Arafat rejected calls for an insurrection against King Hussein. We discussed the question of overthrowing Hussein very seriously and very frequently, said Daoud. Arafat always said no. He told us that making war against Hussein or any Arab regimes was not the path to liberation. Well, the moment was soon to pass. In September 1970, Hussein's forces finally struck. Thousands of Fedayeen were killed in Black September, and guerrilla organisations were eventually forced out of Jordan into Lebanon via Syria. The implications for the movement were bleak. It had been crushed in a country with a majority of, with a majority Palestinian population by a state apparatus that was disunited and weak. The PLO never recovered from this debacle. And these are some of the posters of the period in 1970 referring to Black September. These are the Israeli and US funded arms used by the Jordanian monarchy. And here the slogan, overthrow the butcher, Hussein, victory to Palestine. Well, in Lebanon, in the mid-1970s, the PLO found itself drawn into a civil war, the target of the fascist Lebanese Falange and hounded by both Syrian and Israeli forces that invaded the country from the east and south. In 1982, Israel launched a massive ground invasion, eventually driving out the PLO. The exodus of PLO fighters from the camps provided Israel with the opportunity to wage a campaign of terror, culminating in the notorious Falangist massacre of thousands of Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. The armed struggle as a strategy for national liberation was effectively over at this point. The confrontations, first with Jordan's King Hussein and then with the Falangists and Syrian forces in Lebanon, did not lead the PLO's Fatah leadership to draw the conclusion that it must break with its policy of non-interference and alliances with Arab regimes. On the contrary, the PLO's defeat and its subsequent isolation reinforced such a policy. Well, the next phase of the struggle, the First Intifada, emerged outside of the structures of the PLO. In 1988, a new generation of Palestinians who had grown up under Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip mobilised to shake the Israeli occupation to its foundations. Since its 1967 invasion, Israel had moved rapidly to colonise the occupied territories. Settler communities were established in similar fashion to those of the 19th century European colonial powers. Fortified enclaves on land seized from local villages was set aside for the exclusive use of Israelis. By 1988, half of the West Bank land and a third of land in Gaza was in Israeli hands. The Palestinian population was mobilised as a cheap source of labour for the Israeli economy. A third of all West Bank and Gaza workers depended upon employment in Israel under conditions similar to the Bantustan system of apartheid South Africa. The Intifada engaged the whole of Palestinian society in Gaza and West Bank and the West Bank in strikes, boycotts, rallies and other actions organised by popular committees outside of the PLO's control. As one report from Ramallah noted, while firmly adhering to the slogan that the PLO is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, activists here have taken the initiative on the ground. The voice of this leadership is communal and anonymous. Some traditional nationalist leaders have been overwhelmed by events and relegated to clearly marginal roles. The First Intifada was a spontaneous uprising that had begun outside of Fatah's control. Its unified command represented politically diverse forces on the ground. Hamas formed in 1989 as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, coordinated its activities with the command alongside various other factions, including the PFLP and the DFLP, who I mentioned earlier. However, no force was ultimately capable of contesting Fatah's domination of the movement. And I've got here a few pictures here that may be familiar from the period of the First Intifada. Across the Middle East and North Africa, solidarity demonstrations erupted in Egypt. Protests took place on university campuses and following Friday prayers. In the industrial centre of Mahalla, Al-Kubra, workers fought police in a demonstration calling for the overthrow of the dictator Mubarak and an end to his regime's ties to the US and the International Monetary Fund. Here, the issue of Palestine remained raw. Mubarak's predecessor, President Anwar Sadat, signing of a treaty with Israel was viewed as a calamitous betrayal of the Palestinian. Palestinian cause. In October 1988, mass protests and strikes erupted against austerity measures in Algeria, drawing inspiration from the Palestinian Intifada. Ahmed Ben Bella, a former FLN fighter and Algeria's first president, deposed soon after Algerian independence, declared that Algerians should unite and take matters into their own hands, like the Palestinians did in their Intifada. Ben Bella accused Algeria's authoritarian president, Chadli Bentedib, of speaking only the language of tanks and urging people to resist, even with stones like the Palestinians. The rulers of neighbouring Morocco and Tunisia, as well as Egyptian President Mubarak and Saudi Arabian King Fahd, hurried to support Bentedib, fearing the contagion would spread. Arab leaders urged Washington to open a dialogue with the PLO, hoping to defuse the crisis. The US, in turn, called on the PLO to recognise the State of Israel. Arafat obliged and the US agreed to talks. Arafat now had a bargaining chip. The Intifada served as a means of pressuring the US to push for a mini-state in the occupied Palestinian territories. First touted in 1974 as a staging post for the reclamation of the whole of historic Palestine, the mini-state now became an end in itself. For Israel's ruling Likud party, talks of a Palestinian mini-state was anathema to its dream of control over all the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir declared that not a single centimetre of the West Bank and Gaza would be made over to a Palestinian state. Israel's Labour opposition agreed to some accommodation with the PLO, but with significant qualifications. In essence, these were that Israel should not abandon its colonial settlements in the West Bank and Gaza, the mini-state should be policed by Israel and their neighbouring Arab states, that the mini-state should have no army, and the mini-state should remain under Israel's economic domination. All of that probably sounds familiar when you look at the PA's authority today. In 1968, the PLO had forecast that a mini-state would be a pseudo-entity that would become a colony exploited by Israel. The 1993-94 Oslo Accords formalised the PLO's retreat, and its earlier prediction now came to pass. Well, a month after the signing of the Oslo Accords, how am I doing for time? Yeah, okay, cool. A month after the signing of the Oslo Accords, Palestinian author Edward Said described the agreement as an instrument of Palestinian surrender, a Palestinian Versailles. Said described the farcical ceremony most aptly on the White House lawn, which is pictured here. The degrading spectacle of Yasser Arafat on the right, thanking everyone for the suspension of most of his people's rights, and the fatuous solemnity of Bill Clinton's performance, like a 20th century Roman emperor shepherding two vassal kings through rituals of reconciliation and obeisance. All these only temporarily obscure the truly astonishing proportions of the Palestinian capitulation. Under Oslo, Israel seized the most fertile agricultural lands of the West Bank for its settlement expansion, took control over water resources, and began construction of a network of settler-only roads. In 1998, Ariel Sharon, then Israeli foreign minister, told Jewish settlers, "Everyone should take action, should run, should grab more hills, we'll expand the area. Whatever is seized will be ours. Whatever isn't seized will end up in their hands." In 2000, after becoming Israeli president, Sharon visited the Muslim holy site of Haram Esh Sharif in East Jerusalem. It was the final straw for Palestinians who had seen massive theft of their land, sparking the Second Intifada. In contrast with the First Intifada, the Second Intifada failed to achieve a sustained mass uprising. It rapidly transformed into a profoundly unequal confrontation between the armed combatants of Palestinian factions and the might of the Israeli army. Arafat was once again cornered, this time in Ramallah, in his Ramallah compound, surrounded by Israeli tanks. And that picture there is during Israel's Operation Defensive Shield, where they invaded much of the West Bank with tanks. In 2004, Arafat died. His anointed successor, Mahmoud Abbas, continued a policy of appeasing Israel, pursuing close diplomatic ties with neighbouring Arab states and austerity at home. The Oslo Accords had opened the door to a more rapid incorporation of the occupied Palestinian territories into the Israeli economy. By 2005, almost 75% of imports to the occupied Palestinian territories originated in Israel, while 88% of OPT exports were channeled back to Israel. For the mass of Palestinians, conditions under the occupation were growing inexorably worse. Between 1999 and 2007, Palestinian GDP per capita fell by two-thirds. 56% of West Bank households and 75% of Gaza households fell below the poverty line. In 2007, Abbas appointed Salam Fayyad as the PA's Prime Minister. In collaboration with the World Bank, Fayyad engineered the Palestinian Reform and Development Plan. Like post-apartheid South Africa's Reconstruction and Development Plan, it was a recipe for neoliberalism. Adam Hania observes, the Palestinian economic vision is to have a... Sorry, this is not Adam Hania. This is directly from Fayyad's Palestinian Reform and Development Plan. The plan states, the Palestinian economic vision is to have a diversified and thriving free market economy led by a pioneering private sector that is in harmony with the Arab world, is open to regional and global markets, and that provides the economic basis for a free, democratic and equitable society. But it made for anything but a free, democratic and equitable society. Under the plan, shopping malls, hotels, restaurants and luxury car showrooms and gated communities proliferated, creating the illusion of prosperity. Lands were seized from Palestinian farmers to make way for new industrial zones, in which joint ventures with Israeli companies allowed Palestine's tiny bourgeoisie to exploit poorly paid Palestinian labour. The West Bank's development bubble was funded with loans to American and Gulf banks. With the onslaught of the global financial crisis, the bubble burst. By 2012, a quarter of the workforce in the Palestinian territories was unemployed, and real wages had declined significantly. The hardship now faced by Palestinians living under occupation only added to the resentment that had built up during the decades of negotiations that had delivered nothing. Fatah's fortunes had long since declined. Its rival Hamas, now in control of the Gaza Strip, had emerged the dominant player in the struggle for Palestinian liberation. Well, is Hamas an alternative? And what kind of alternative? Formed on the eve of the First Intifada in 1987, Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement, drew on a long lineage of Islamic resistance to Zionist settler colonialism. Hamas's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades, is named after Islamic preacher Izz ad-Din Al-Qassam, referred to earlier in this talk. The Muslim Brotherhood, from which Hamas emerged, sought to combat British colonialism and its sponsorship of Zionism in Palestine by seeking to spread an Islamic revivalist message. Hamas continued in this tradition, establishing charitable foundations funded by wealthy Palestinians abroad and Gulf-based capitalists to carry out its work. Hamas opposed the Oslo Accords, vehemently denouncing the PLO's recognition of Israel. When the PA was established in 1994, Hamas and critics of Oslo generally found themselves shut out of state institutions. Hamas cadre instead obtained work in institutions funded by charitable donations from abroad, such as schools, hospitals and Gaza's Islamic University. Hamas charities distributed food, clothes and educational materials. Hamas's efforts to ameliorate the dire conditions faced by Palestinians stood in stark contrast to the neoliberal Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority. Hamas emerged at a time when Islamic organisations across the Middle East had eclipsed the left and secular nationalists as the most visible and outspoken critics of US imperialism. By the mid-2000s, Hamas had come out of the Second Intifada with a battle-hardened armed wing. All of these factors contributed to Hamas's ability to tap Palestinians' discontent with Oslo and present itself as the only viable alternative to Fatah. In 2006, Hamas won elections for the PA's Legislative Council. Its change and reform list captured 74 out of 132 seats, and Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh became Prime Minister. The Hamas victory created great consternation in Tel Aviv and Washington, which backed a Fatah coup in Gaza led by Mohamed Dahlan. When this backfired, Hamas succeeded in driving Fatah forces from the territory. There were now two separate Palestinian authorities, with Hamas in control in Gaza and the PA under Abbas continuing to rule the West Bank, though with no mandate to do so. Israel responded by sealing Gaza off from the rest of the world with the connivance of Egyptian dictator Mubarak, and in December 2008 launched a massive air and land assault on the territory. Hamas marshalled an impressive resistance to Israel's military offensives in 2008, 2009, and again in 2014. These military operations, which killed thousands, failed in their stated aim of dislodging Hamas from power. However, combined with a crippling decade-long blockade of Gaza and a concerted international media campaign to brand them as Muslim fundamentalists and terrorists, they contributed to Hamas seeking compromise with Fatah. On the 1st of May last year, Hamas released its updated political charter just days before a White House meeting between Trump and Abbas. It revealed Hamas's most significant concessions to date. While claiming that the organisation's ultimate goal is the liberation of all of historic Palestine, the charter, Section 20, states, Hamas considers the establishment of a fully sovereign and independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital along the lines of the 4th of June 1967 to be a formula of national consensus. That's a reference to the Green Line and essentially the basis of the two-state solution. Additionally, the charter talks of managing resistance and managing conflict in an apparent retreat from armed struggle, though there's a lot of conflicting messages on that theme. At a press conference following the release of the charter, the Gaza-based deputy head of Hamas's political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh asserted, the new document will undermine neither our principles nor our strategy. Jerusalem, the right of return, Palestinian unity, and resistance forces are fundamental principles. The changes relate to regional developments and suit the era. Despite the immediate rejection by the US and Israel, the new charter signals intent to embrace the logic of Oslo, a Palestinian mini-state alongside the State of Israel. It positions Hamas as a potential partner of government inside a reconstituted PLO. Drawing a leaf from Fatah's book, the new Hamas charter also enshrines the organisation's political neutrality regarding the internal affairs of any country. In other words, Hamas could dutifully remain silent while two of its principal backers, the dictatorships of Iran and Syria, unleashed brutal force against their own populations. The Arab Spring, a regional-wide uprising that toppled Egypt, Tunisia and Libya's dictators and threatened to unseat several more, proved a potent test for both Fatah and Hamas. A sense of common destiny united Palestinians with their Arab neighbours. Mahmoud Abbas soon made clear which side of the barricades he stood, telephoning both Mubarak and Tunisian dictator Ben Ali to offer his support. Abbas also directed the PA's police to attack demonstrators supporting the uprisings in Ramallah. In January 2011, in Gaza City, masses of Palestinians celebrated the fall of Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak. Borrowing slogans from Tunis and Cairo, they shouted, "The people want to bring Abbas down." Similar scenes took place in Amman, where Palestinians also called for the overthrow of Abbas. And this is a quote from Electronic Intifada editor Ali Abunima, which I'll read. "The revolution has reawakened a sense of common destiny for the Arab world many thought had long been lost. That seemed naive when our mothers and fathers told us about it from their youth, and that Arab leaders had certainly tried to kill. The Arab dictators thought their people's spirits were dead too. The revolutions have restored a sense of limitless possibility and a desire that change should spread from country to country." In Cairo, after Mubarak's ouster, Egyptians expressed their solidarity with the Palestinian cause by storming and sacking the Israeli embassy. They demanded the SCAF military regime that had succeeded Mubarak cancel its treaties and tear up its trade agreements with Israel and open the Rafah border crossing to Gaza. A delegation of activists entered Gaza in defiance of the Egyptian military regime. As the protests spread, emboldened by the fall of the Mubarak regime, Abbas panicked. He sacked his entire cabinet and promised elections that I don't think have ever come to be. In July, with his position looking more secure, Abbas made hollow calls for Arab Spring protests against the occupation. In 2012, while Assad butchered opponents in the streets of Damascus, Hamas abandoned its Damascus headquarters and its relations with Iran cooled. Instead, it sought to cultivate ties with the rising Sunni powers in the region, specifically Egypt, Turkey and Qatar, Egypt now led by the Muslim Brotherhood. Yet the Brotherhood's stay in power in Egypt was short-lived. Mass protests against austerity measures provided an opportunity for the Egyptian military to claw its way back into power and install General Sisi, a Washington-based stooge, into the presidency. Sisi, a key ally of Israel, swiftly tightened the blockade of Gaza. Hamas has reportedly restored friendly relations with Iran, even while the Iranian militia continue to attack democratic opposition forces in Syria, as Iran's militia acting as proxies for the Assad regime. Last August, Hamas Gaza leader Yahya al-Sinwar told journalists, "The relationship today is developing and returning to what it was in the old days. The shifting sands of Hamas's political allegiances underlie its weakness. Like Fatah, it has long fostered relations with reactionary regimes, albeit those in the crosshairs of Washington, and like Fatah, as its cadres have been absorbed into the state institutions that govern the Gaza Strip, Hamas has become increasingly intolerant of popular mobilisations, or any that protest Hamas. It's still quite supportive of mobilisations that protest the occupation." In the wake of Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the PA has scrambled to reinvent itself as an organisation committed to Palestinian national liberation. On the 7th of December, the PLO's Secretary-General and Chief Negotiator, Saeb Erekat, told reporters that Trump and Netanyahu have managed to destroy that hope of a two-state solution and declared, "Our struggle should focus on one thing, equal rights." Palestinian politicians Abbas and Erekat are caught in a bind. After being tossed aside by Trump, having outlived their usefulness to Washington, they remain dependent on financing from the Gulf states and the European Union to keep the PA alive. However, these states will follow Trump in cutting off funding for the PA if the PLO recants its recognition of and security coordination with the Israeli apartheid state. In the Gaza Strip, Hamas faces a similar dilemma. Its adaptation towards acceptance of a two-state solution is increasingly out of sync with the sentiment of the Palestinian street. Its close relations with Hezbollah and Iran pose a direct challenge to mending relations with Fatah, and it remains literally hemmed in by pro-US governments on either side of the Gaza Strip, each armed to the teeth by Washington. The tide of counter-revolution has set back the struggles unleashed during the Arab Spring. However, the waves of struggle are certain to return. The demonstrations of solidarity with Palestinians that erupted during the Arab Spring, like those with the First Palestinian Intifada some 24 years earlier, demonstrate the ongoing convergence of interests between the Palestinians living under Israeli occupation and the Arab masses living under the heel of authoritarian neoliberal regimes. For the Palestinian working class, whether living in the West Bank, the besieged Gaza Strip, or second-class citizens in Israel, the preservation of the PA only continues their suffering. This talk has demonstrated how Fatah and increasingly Hamas represent a small minority of Palestinians, a Palestinian bourgeoisie who live a life detached from the daily struggle for existence that face the mass of Palestinians. Trump's support for the ultra-right Zionists' maximum program, the complete destruction of historic Palestine and the ethnic cleansing of its inhabitants, poses sharply the need for a new strategy for liberation. That strategy must be one that discards any attempt to confine Palestinian liberation to the administration of small parcels of territory under the watchful eye of an occupying power, and demands the complete liberation of Palestine and the dismantling of Israel's colonial apartheid regime. Such a struggle will need to extend beyond Palestinians living under occupation and engage the Palestinian diaspora and their Arab brothers and sisters across the Middle East and the Maghreb. Today, a call for a reawakening of the Arab Revolution may sound utopian, but the conditions that gave rise to the Arab Spring, a crisis of poverty and inequality, have not disappeared. Moreover, the flame of resistance has not been extinguished. The Tamimi family's defiant resistance of Israel's occupation forces in the village of Nabi Saleh and the mobilisations of tens of thousands on the Gaza border in the last couple of days offer a light in the darkness, an example not only for Palestinians, but for the masses of people across the Arab world. Thank you.